A recent headline from the satirical paper The Onion reads, "Watching episode of Downton Abbey counts as reading book." So fans of the PBS Masterpiece series chalked up a couple more books last night. And the second season of the series about a grand British estate and its inhabitants wraps up next Sunday. We won't spoil anything for you here.
We can tell you that a few anachronisms have made their way into the series, and spotting them has become a hobby for many fans. Joining us, as he does occasionally, is linguist Ben Zimmer. He's the executive producer of Visual Thesaurus and a language columnist for the Boston Globe. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, how would we welcome you appropriately if we were doing this interview in the England of, say, 1916?
What? That's a good question. You know what? I have to admit that I can't magically transport myself back to that time to know how people are speaking. It's much easier to take some dialogue that has been created for something like this and then try to see, well, did they really say that? Did, you know, test it by looking to see how far back expressions really go.
Well, let's hear an example.
I'm just saying.
And I'll just say if you don't look out.
I'm just saying.
Yeah, that was Ethel the maid saying, I'm just saying, to just protect herself a little bit from the wrath of Mrs. Patmore, the cook. And that expression, I'm just saying, is a modern expression that we use to couch what we're saying so that the person doesn't take offense or isn't annoyed by what we're saying and that you're just stating your personal opinion. It's hard to find examples of it really before World War II. That standalone expression, I'm just saying, is pretty modern and out of place in 1916 when that episode takes place.
All right, let's choose another one.
Sorry to keep you waiting, but we're going to have to step on it.
So that was Lord Grantham telling his chauffeur that we're going to have to step on it. And step on it is another Americanism. It starts off as an American expression, and it was in use in the 1910s. There were chauffeur expressions being used to describe acceleration. Step on it, step on her tail, sort of imagining the pedal to be like the tail of an animal, like a cat that you would step on and it would jerk forward. Those were American expressions, and they would eventually get across the Atlantic. But to imagine that Lord Grantham was up on the latest American slang in 1917 strains the imagination just a bit.
That brings us to another expression that would not have crossed over in any likelihood, and that is this one.
When push comes to shove, I'd rather do it myself.
And that was Mrs. Patmore, the cook. Now, Ben, would she have said, when push comes to shove?
She would definitely not have been familiar with that expression. It does date to the late 19th century, but it was a strictly African-American expression for at least a few decades. The Oxford English Dictionary has examples back to 1898, but if you look through the early 20th century, all the examples that we can find of the expression when push comes to shove come from African-American newspapers and other sources. And it really isn't until after World War II or so that it spreads to more widespread usage. So it's extremely unlikely that Mrs. Patmore would have been familiar with that expression and have used it in 1919.
Ben Zimmer is the language columnist for the Boston Globe. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
And you can find more lines of historically questionable dialogue handpicked by Ben Zimmer from Downton Abbey's second season at npr.org. This is NPR News. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. Of all the items in Mitt Romney's political record, few are more awkward than the health care law he signed in Massachusetts in 2006. It extended insurance coverage to the overwhelming majority of people while still relying on private companies. What's problematic is that Republicans want to make the 2012 elections a referendum on the health care law that President Obama signed, and so Romney's opponents in the presidential race are attacking him on it, as Rick Santorum did in a South Carolina debate.
He put forth Romney Care, which was not a bottom-up free market system. It was a government-run healthcare system that was the basis of Obamacare, and it has been an abject failure, and he has stood by it.
NPR's Richard Knox now begins a series on Romney Care, as Senator Santorum and others call it, which is not controversial in its home state.
A lot of people here in Massachusetts don't call it Romney Care because it took the support of a lot of other people to get it passed. But it's true, Romney got the ball rolling. When I interviewed him in 2006, he said he got the idea talking to Massachusetts business leaders.
The key insight was this.
people who don't have insurance nonetheless receive health care, and it's expensive.
Romney saw that a state fund that provided free care, paid for by a surcharge on private insurance, was spending $1 billion a year.
My question was, could we take that $1 billion and help the poor purchase their insurance, let them pay what they can afford, we'd subsidize what they can't.
And he proposed a requirement that people buy private health insurance if they're able.
We're going to say, folks, if you can afford health care, then gosh, you better go get it. Otherwise, you're just passing on your expenses to someone else. That's not Republican, that's not Democratic, that's not Libertarian, that's just wrong.
The Massachusetts plan has had strong and steady support and little opposition. Last year, an attempt to repeal the part that requires most people to have insurance couldn't get enough signatures. Only 39 people have liked its Facebook page. And the current governor, Democrat Deval Patrick, says the health plan Romney launched is working.
I think it's just been a terrific success and a statement of value about our values here, about how, you know, people are not all on their own, that we are in this together.
To find out how it's working, I stopped by the office of Dufour Florisson, a self-employed Haitian-American businessman.
Richard.
Hi.
How you doing? I'm sorry for the wait.
It's a busy place here.
It's busy. It's a time. You know, that's the income taxes season.
Florisson has a tax preparation and insurance business. He's also a pastor who's worked with a group called Greater Boston Interfaith Organization that helped get the health law passed.
Close to 500,000 people didn't have health insurance because of the passing of the law. They had health insurance.
And one of them, it turns out, is Florisson. He used to be a mortgage broker, but his business crashed in 2008. He couldn't pay his health insurance premiums. But under the new law, he qualified for state-subsidized insurance.
My premium just dropped from $1,200 on a monthly basis and paid $770 for the same coverage for the same family of four.
And when his income dropped again, so did his health insurance premium.
The law has been extremely good for me, and also just to many other low-income families.
But he admits not all of his business colleagues like the law.
They complain the fact that they were forced, basically, obligated just to purchase health insurance. So I explained to them it's much better just to have health insurance and not having it.
In fact, contrary to some predictions, there's been a substantial jump in the percentage of Massachusetts businesses offering insurance. When I called the Massachusetts Restaurant Association, they said they didn't know of any restaurants that don't offer coverage. That surprised me. In the past, restaurant owners have been among the most opposed to health laws like this one. And the nationally controversial individual mandate, which requires citizens to buy health insurance if they can afford it, hasn't proved to be such a big deal. Andrew Dreyfus is president of the state's largest insurer, Blue Cross Blue Shield.
The individual mandate has not been controversial in Massachusetts.
The sky didn't fall.
The sky did not fall. And by the way, we have much stronger penalties around the individual mandate than the national law does. And despite that, the sky did not fall.
The penalty for not buying insurance can be on the order of $1,200 a year for a 37-year-old single person in Boston. But only about 1% of taxpayers end up paying any penalty. Meanwhile, a new survey in the journal Health Affairs shows that more Massachusetts citizens are seeing a doctor regularly. Fewer are going to emergency rooms for care, and the percentage who rate their health as good or excellent is going up. That doesn't mean everything about Massachusetts health care is wonderful. The 2006 law didn't do anything about controlling health costs, which were already among the nation's highest. Dreyfus says that's at the top of the agenda now.
When suddenly every employer is offering insurance, everyone is paying for it, and the government is subsidizing it, and it's growing at 8 or 10% per year, year over year, suddenly there's a lot more interest in doing something about it.
Because everybody recognizes that Massachusetts can't keep requiring people to buy health insurance if they can't afford it. Tomorrow, we'll look at how Massachusetts is tackling that big problem. Richard Knox, NPR News, Boston.
Now, if you're not already out of bed, maybe this will help you.
Wake up! Wake up, wake up, wake up! Up you wake, up you wake, up you wake, up you wake! This is Mr. Senior Love Daddy, your voice...
Samuel Jackson in the movie Do the Right Thing with quite a wake-up call. Maybe Renee and I should try that. But if you still feel sluggish and drowsy after you're up, do not blame us because it could be the quality of your sleep. New technology devices are available now, all claiming to help improve your sleep and your health. Rich Jaroslawski has been reviewing them for Bloomberg News. He's a technology columnist there, and he talked with Renee about those technologies.
Welcome to the program, and I'm going to start by saying, are you like everybody else? I mean, do you have sleep problems?
I think I am.
In my case, I can get to sleep, but I never get enough sleep. And I think millions of Americans feel the same way.
So let's talk about these new devices. What are they supposed to do? What magic are they supposed to deliver?
Well, they take advantage of all the technology that already surrounds us, whether it's our smartphones or our personal computers. And what they're trying to do is measure how well we sleep and how long we sleep. The idea being that if it's something that we can track, we can improve by adopting healthier habits.
I have a couple of these devices sitting here with me on the table. And one of them is called Sleep Tracker. And it looks like a big watch. It looks like almost an underwater watch. And what it promises to do is to help you wake up at the ideal moment in your sleep cycle.
Exactly. The idea is if you wake up from a deep sleep, you're going to feel groggy. So what you do with these devices is that you give them a time that you say, I want to wake up by 6:45, for example. And because they're monitoring your sleep cycles while you're asleep, they will look for a time in the window 15 minutes or 20 minutes before that set alarm time where you're in a light sleep phase where you are more likely to wake up refreshed.
Right. So you have to put a device, though, on your wrist. There's another one here you put on your forehead, sort of like a sweatband with something stuck to it on the front. Tell us about this one.
This is the Zio. And what you're seeing here, there's a device that's about the size of a money clip, and the sensor is in that. And it's attached to this headband that you put on, which makes you look pretty ridiculous.
Yeah, this one will keep your partner up all night.
Well, it certainly, I don't know that you want to look in the mirror when you're wearing this one. And you wear it over your forehead. So it's detecting things like the electrical impulses in your brain, your eye movements, and it's capturing all this data. And then it will wirelessly transmit it to your phone where there's a free app that Zio provides that will allow you to track of what kind of sleep, whether it's REM sleep, how much deep sleep you've had, how many times you awaken during the night. And all those things go into calculating the quality of your sleep. And the idea is if you can track it and quantify it, you can improve it.
Now, none of these technologies are very streamlined, and certainly none of them are invisible. What, though, might they tell us about what we might see down the road?
The really significant thing about these things is what they augur for the future. They are all part of a trend called connected health and another trend called wearable technology. So you can imagine when one of these things might be shrunk down to the size of a button on your pajamas that is wirelessly communicating with a mobile device that's plugged in next to the bed, providing you with much better data and much more data and allowing you to share that data wirelessly with a doctor or healthcare provider. So you can kind of see where this is all going. But the fact is we're right now at such an early, early stage that some of these things can be a little bit clunky. You really got to be dedicated if you're going to wear a headband to bed every night.
Rich Jaroslawski is technology columnist for Bloomberg News and a regular guest on our program. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
What makes a song a weeper?
Like your hair standing up on end, shivers going down your spine, a lump coming to your throat, even tears running down your eyes.
And why is this song in particular such an emotional powder keg?
I heard that you're settled down, that you found a girl and you're married now.
That's the aching ballad, Someone Like You, which won the British singer Adele one of her 6 Grammy Awards last night. Before that, we heard John Sloboda, professor of music psychology at London's Guildhall School of Music and Drama. As we read in the Wall Street Journal, Sloboda has studied physical reactions to music, and he found that one musical ornament in particular triggers a strong emotional reaction. It's called appoggiatura, from the Italian word to lean. And while it's tough to define, basically, musically, it's not unlike a grace note, sometimes dissonant, that resolves into a main note. So when Adele sings the word you in the chorus, you're hearing a poggiatura.
Never mind, I'll find someone like you.
That little vocal dip there on the word you, well, according to Professor Sloboda, that is key in triggering an emotional response in a listener.
And each time that happens, there's a little tension, which is then released. So tension release each time. And this goes on quite subconsciously. Basically, the music taps into this very primitive system that we have, which identifies emotion on the basis of a violation of expectancy. So it's like a little upset, if you like, which then gets resolved or made better in the chord that follows.
So what about that theory? Well, we ran it by someone who should know.
I'm Dan Wilson, and I wrote with Adele the song Someone Like You.
Well, Dan Wilson, does the term appoggiatura mean anything to you?
I saw the term appoggiatura for the first time in an article in the Wall Street Journal about why Someone Like You makes people cry, and it's sort of talked about that Adele and I had used this secret trick of putting appoggiaturas in, but I didn't know what that was.
Dan Wilson says he now knows what it means, but he has another theory for why that song drives people to tears.
A good song allows us, the listeners, to walk through the songwriter or composer's thoughts and emotions as they wrote the song. You know, it's why when you listen to The Replacements, you get this kind of giddy drunk feeling, probably because they were drunk when they recorded and wrote their song, you know. And with Adele, we wrote this song that was about a desperately heartbreaking end of a relationship, and she was really, really feeling it at the time, and we were imaginatively creating that walked her back through that experience. And when you and I listen to the song, we walk in her shoes through that heartbreaking experience, but it's in our imaginations. And so instead of being devastating, we're like children play acting. We get to have an imaginative experience. But hey, if I had a scientific method for making a heartbreaking hit,
you'd do it every
day. I would be using it every day of the week. So, but it's not so easy.
Dan Wilson co-wrote the song Someone Like You with Adele and plays piano on it. Dan Wilson, congratulations on the Grammy. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Sometimes it lasts in love, but sometimes it hurts instead. Never mind, I'll find someone like you. I wish nothing but the best for you too. Don't forget me, I think I'll remember you say. Sometimes it lasts in love, but sometimes it hurts.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep. Today in your health, we plunge into energy drinks after we take a look at fiber, which is in almost every aisle of the grocery store. Food manufacturers are putting fiber into foods where you would not expect to find it, hoping to make their products look more healthful, which raises the question, are they actually more healthful? Amy Stanton of member station KQED went to find out.
I'm standing here at the grocery store, and I'm facing this wall of really sugary kid cereals. And a lot of them have this label on it. It says, good source of fiber. Which, if you think about it, may say more about us, the shoppers, than it does about what's in this box.
We're looking for elements within things. Almost a mystical kind of thinking.
John Swartzberg is a professor of public health at the University of California, Berkeley, and he believes that mankind's love affair with food additives, for example, fiber, can be traced back to a single moment in history, British Navy, 1747.
Well, they realized that when the sailors were eating citrus fruits, they didn't get this terrible disease called scurvy.
You may have heard this story. A Scottish surgeon named James Lind started giving sailors limes, found that scurvy virtually disappeared.
That's how the English sailors got the name limeys.
This launched the idea that specific isolated ingredients in foods could prevent, sometimes even cure, diseases. And often they could.
These things led us to think that, well, we just have to find these magic bullets within foods that we replace and will be much better.
And the legacy of this, says Swartzberg, is on full display at any modern grocery store.
Well, we can start with, like, breakfast cereal.
With me shopping was Jan Matsuno. She's a food scientist for the Center for Culinary Development, a research firm in San Francisco. Matsuno has watched the trends come and go. The low carbs, the omega-3s. She says what's enabled the fiber craze is, in part, chemistry.
It's very interesting. You can get these powdered, soluble fibers, and you can put them into a glass of water, and it just dissolves, and it looks and tastes exactly like water. It's amazing.
Take white bread.
Yeah, so here, good source of fiber.
Matsuno reads off the list of ingredients.
Sugar cane fiber, oat fiber, a resistant cornstarch also can be fiber.
All, just to be clear, additives that you would not normally find in white bread.
So what does it bring the fiber up to here? Again, 3 grams.
In the world of food labeling, 3 grams of fiber is kind of a magic number. It's the minimum amount that you can pack into a product and still have the words good source of fiber on the label. But that designation, says Matsuno, is a little bit generous.
An apple with the peel is 5 grams of fiber.
The bigger question here is whether these fiber-fortified foods are making you any healthier. And this turns out to be one of those places where scientists know a lot less than you may think they do. For example, a lot of people think that fiber will help protect you against colon cancer. But so far, that link is not conclusive. There's a stronger connection between fiber and cardiovascular disease. Again, John Swartzberg from UC Berkeley.
There's a lot of data on fiber that suggests that, yeah, there may be less cardiovascular disease in people who eat a high fiber diet.
In other words, people who eat lots of fruits, vegetables, and legumes have lower rates of heart disease. But no one knows exactly why this is. Why do fiber-rich foods appear to prevent heart disease? Is it the fiber, or is it something else in those foods? Maybe it's a combination of things. Maybe there is no single magic bullet. And so you have to ask.
If we're not sure what it is in fruits and vegetables, then as opposed to saying, well, it's probably the fiber or it's probably this or that, why not just have people eat lots of fruits and vegetables?
Now, some food scientists are less critical of these fiber additives. They say many Americans are always going to choose junk food over fruits and vegetables, so you might as well put some fiber in there, even if we don't really know how much benefit it's having. But what pretty much everyone agrees is this. Given a choice between fiber-fortified sugar cereal and an apple, you're better off with the apple.
I don't want people to think that by adding things to unhealthy foods, it somehow makes them healthy. And I think that's the most important message.
One thing we do know about some synthetic fiber additives, too much of them can give you gas. But don't expect to see that mentioned on the front of your cereal box. For NPR News, I'm Amy Standen.
There's only 2 songs nominated for a Best Original Song Oscar this year. One of them is Man or Muppet from the movie The Muppets. We're going to hear the story behind the song from its composer and lyricist, Brett McKenzie. He's half of the satirical music duo Flight of the Conchords, which started an HBO series of the same name. McKenzie wrote several of the songs for the Muppets. Let's hear the Oscar-nominated one. The movie stars Jason Segel as a guy whose half-brother is a Muppet named Walter. Walter has always lived in the human world and has gone on a pilgrimage to the old Muppet studio in L.A. He's accompanied by Segel and his girlfriend. After Segel's girlfriend leaves him, accusing him of caring more about the Muppets than her, he sings about his identity crisis, and Walter sings about his own crisis in the song Man or Muppet.
I reflect on my reflection, and I ask myself the question, what's the right direction? Go. I don't know. Am I a man or am I a muppet?
Am I a muppet?
If I'm a muppet, then I'm a very manly muppet.
Very manly muppet.
Am I a muppet?
Muppet.
Or am I a man?
Am I a man?
If I'm a man, me a muppet of a man.
A muppet of a man.
Brett McKenzie, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations on the nomination. Such a great choice for them, for them to have made. I love that song.
Thanks very much.
You are welcome. So when the screenwriters told you that they needed this song, what did they tell you about what they needed?
The script was already written, and
Jason Segel, Nick Stoller, who wrote the script, and James Bowman had sort of...
He was the director, yeah.
James Bowman, the director, they had song briefs. And Man or Muppet, it was just it said Man or Muppet, and they wanted a song about being a man or a Muppet. And then James had this visual idea that the man would see a reflection of himself as a Muppet, and the Muppet, Walter, would see a reflection of himself as a man. So within the song, it needed to incorporate some sort of echoey sort of idea so that you could go between the two characters within the melody.
And I love the line, if I'm a Muppet, then I'm a very manly Muppet. If I'm a man, that makes me a Muppet kind of man.
A Muppet of a man, yeah.
Yeah. How did that come to you?
Well, first of all, you can't call the Muppets puppets, right? So that took out that rhyming option. Early on, I was going to get Puppet in there, but you can't do that. So
that breaks the Muppet code.
Yeah, it breaks the code. Yeah, Muppets are real. And so then I was just riffing as to how I could create that, get that melody and those lyrics to flip back and forth. And that's why I end up rhyming Muppet with Muppet and Man with Man.
Do you see this song as a Muppet power ballad?
Absolutely. Yeah, I really wanted to do a power ballad tune and just wanted it to be as dramatic as I possibly could get it to be.
So is there certain songs or certain performers you were thinking of when you wrote this? You know, like power ballad performers.
Yeah, I was really influenced by Harry Nilsson's Without You. And
sing
Eric
a few
Carmen's
lines so people know
All
the song
By
you're
Myself.
Talking about.
You know the one, I can't live if living is without you. I can't give, I can't take anymore. And it's just so epic, man. I mean, Harry Nilsson's got the best voice ever. And he sang that, you know, at the height of his career, just when his voice was still there before he started partying like a maniac with John Lennon. And then Eric Carmen's song, All By Myself, which I love that song. A friend of mine used to sing it when she was single, and you know, with a group of couples going, all by myself, don't want to be all by myself anymore. Both those songs have a very similar feel, I think. And so what I wanted to do was get this Man or Muppet song to be like one of those, like a really heart-wrenching, genuinely sincere, you know, power ballad about being a man or a Muppet.
And then there's a part where Jason Segel's like bending over in agony and shaking his fists.
It's a great visual. He's on the street in like a downtown Los Angeles street, and the rain's flooding down him. He's buckled over just in the agony of the melody. It's a sort of turning point in the movie. So he realizes he's a man, and the Muppet guy, Walter, realizes he's a Muppet. So it's a crucial moment in the movie as well.
Of them finding their real identity.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean... It's what I like about it is it kind of, I think everyone's had that crisis at some point trying to figure out whether they're a man or a Muppet. So it's a real theme song for everyone.
It's kind of true.
Well, I like the idea of people having that crisis driving around singing it to themselves, trying to figure it out.
I sing that to myself all the time, actually. I love the song. So in early on, Jason Segel has to sing, What's the Right Direction to Go? tell me about making sure he said like lots of echoey ends in there.
That was one of those things that I was just doing as I was sitting on the piano, and then I just made him copy it. I would sing a line and he'd watch me through the studio window, and I'd sing it quite dramatically, and then he'd just copy me. And so that's how we kind of got the performance going.
I know that there's a Muppet code, like you can't call the Muppets puppets. Because people are supposed to believe that they're real mm-hmm. living creatures. What are some of the other things that you were told you couldn't do in the songs that you were writing?
One of the mistakes I made was thinking that chickens and penguins could sing, just like all the other animals in the Muppets. But it turns out that those animals are not allowed to actually sing words. They can just cluck and quack. And then I also had another line... I had one of the Muppets reminiscing, I remember when I was just a little piece of felt, and that got shut down pretty soon as well, because the Muppets are real, and they never were bits of material in their world. And then The other one was I was really tempted to have the line Mother Frogger in there.
Yeah.
And that got shut down for being a little bit too grown up.
So did they explain why chickens and penguins can only cluck and quack, why they can't sing like the other Muppets?
No, it's just one of those things that they created years ago. I mean, it's great in the early shows where, you know, Gonzo loves the chickens, and they just go, bawk, bawk, when they talk back to Gonzo. So it's a good setup that they can't talk and they can only quack. But I mean, cluck. But it was funny in the studio when I was like, okay, now the penguins sing this line, and the Muppeteers, very serious guys, were just like, I can't sing that line. The penguins won't, they don't say the words.
Is that how you learned it? That they can't sing?
Yeah, that's how I learned in the studio, and they told me. I was like, okay. They take it very seriously. Fair enough, you know. And they sometimes in the studio, they're kind of method Muppets where they, in between takes, they stay in character. So I'm in the studio, we do a take, and then I'm like, can we do it again? Can you try it just a little more energy or something like that? And then they talk back to you as Fozzie the Bear, or whoever they are.
Seriously?
So it's like I'm having a conversation with the Muppet in there. It's pretty strange. Very surreal job.
Wow. So as we record this, it looks like the two nominated songs, are not going to be performed at the Oscars. I feel cheated, but probably not nearly as cheated as you feel.
I was disappointed when I found that out. That was just the other night. And I mean, I'm not complaining to have to go to the Oscars. I'm pretty excited about it all. But yeah, it would have been fun to get a man and a Muppet up there.
Do you know why they're not performing the songs?
I don't actually. I'm not sure. I mean, it seems crazy. From my experience, it's always good to put a couple of songs in a show. so I don't know. It just seems that, like, even if they weren't going to broadcast it, they could just have them and then cut them.
It's a live show.
Oh, it's live. Oh, that's probably their problem. Maybe they're worried that we're just going to keep singing.
Yeah. If you were doing Man or Muppet at the Oscars, how would you have liked to stage it?
Well, I don't know. I think maybe I would have played some piano and then get Jason Segel and Walter the Muppet up on stage, and then I think them bring in a chorus of background singers with all the Muppets across the back of the stage. Maybe get, you know, Clooney and Pitt up there as well singing along.
Brett McKenzie, thank you so much for talking with us. I really wish you good luck at the Oscars. I love the song. So thank you.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
I'm a man.
Brett McKenzie wrote the song Man or Muppet, which is nominated for an Oscar for Best Original Song. In part two of our interview, which we expect to play in the next few days, he'll talk about the other songs he wrote for the Muppets movie. You can see the Man or Muppet video on our website, freshair.npr.org. This is Fresh Air.